Hello, you're watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. Nadir Token from 27Four Investment Managers in studio today to guide us through all that's happening on global markets. And later in the show, we're also going to be joined by Investec's Ian Cunningham to discuss their global strategic managed fund. All that coming your way shortly. First, though, a quick look at what's been making the headlines. Well, the world's largest online retailer, Amazon, posted a profit of nearly $2 billion, the largest in its history. This was driven by changes to U.S. tax law, which added to the company's bottom line, along with its ability to lock in millions of new customers to its Prime Fast Shipping Club over the holiday season. Meanwhile, Google parent Alphabet missed quarterly profit forecasts of $7 billion, coming in just shy of that at $6.8 billion. This as spending weighed on the technology company. Expenses jumped 27%, driving steady ad sales growth to promote its consumer gadgets. And all eyes on export numbers this week. Import and export data from the world's largest economies will put China back in the spotlight, and along with it, Donald Trump and the threat of protectionism. Here's more.
US President hardly mentioning China and restricting his comments on trade. This week, those issues can hardly be avoided, as the world's number two economy reveals new import and export numbers and the size of its US trade surplus with them.
Clearly China is the big one, and of course that feeds directly into President Trump and his views on people that run large current account and budget surpluses. And here I'm thinking of Germany and in particular China,
which has reported an all-time surplus with the US last year of $275 billion, a year that also saw Chinese exports rise at their quickest in 4 years, in a welcome sign of returning demand.
This is a magnificent period of synchronized growth. The more broad-based the recovery looks to be, the safer it may be in the years ahead.
That safety still vulnerable if protectionism rises. Trump already imposing tariffs on washing machines and solar panels last month. Cheap steel imports and intellectual property rights also seen as hot-button issues, though the rhetoric might be cooling.
Trump has made some very valid points about global trade, about wanting to have sensible, fair and sustainable deals. And in practice, the reality of what Mr. Trump has done is a lot less bad than the bark.
A Chinese yuan up around 10% against the dollar in under a year and a half may play to Trump's agenda by dampening demand for Chinese exports, while a rising euro, close to three-year highs versus the dollar on Friday, is the danger for the eurozone. It also reports trade numbers from its two major economies, France and Germany, this week. Before both, though, and before China, come the first big trade numbers from the US itself on Tuesday.
Nadir Token, portfolio manager at 27Four, joins me in studio now. And so, Nadir, it looked pretty scary on Friday. And I suppose what happened in the US markets on Friday fed through to European markets today. Yep. Also, our markets in South Africa down sharply.
Yep.
But it looks like it's tapered off as the US opened today. So do you think we are in for a big fall, or do you think this was a knee-jerk reaction and perhaps a bit of profit-taking?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think both of the above, you know. Let's not forget that we started the year sprinting out the blocks. You know, at one point, global equity markets across the board were up around 5% at one point in January. You know, corporate earnings are coming through at a very good clip. We've seen a number of companies reporting, which have actually been quite impressive. And companies are investing, you know. So we expected that we're going to continue to see another strong year from global equities, perhaps not another 20% plus year that like we got last year. I mean, that was an absolute gift, you know. But I think we're probably not going to get there this year. But we certainly think, you know, mid-teens is not out the question. And our base case scenario of sort of low to mid-double digits is certainly on the card. So, you know, I think obviously, you know, the 5% returns we saw in the start of January, that wasn't sustainable, you know. So I think a bit of profit taking on the back of that. But there's no doubt that there is concern about interest rates going up quicker. The number seems to be three in a Fed hikes this year. Anytime the market seems to think that the Fed is going to go faster than that, we're going to see some bouts of volatility. At the end of the day, there has been some capital allocation decisions which have been made, which are very marginal, where these companies are barely earning their cost of capital, and that's with interest rates being very, very depressed. Now, obviously, if those long bond yields kick up quite aggressively, which is what we saw through the course of last week. 10-year Treasury is getting to a four-year high, touching just below 290. You know, a lot of those companies, you know, it starts to become questionable whether they're earning their cost of capital, and particularly those companies that have leveraged themselves to invest. I think those are the ones that are in the most tenuous position. But I think overall, overall, you know, the average company certainly not in that position. You know, they haven't over indebted themselves. They're not over leveraged and they're earning a very healthy return on assets and return on invested capital. So I think they'll broadly be okay. But we're going to see bouts of this kind of volatility, certainly, particularly around macroeconomic expectations of what the Fed is going to do around inflation data, wage growth, unemployment numbers, that kind of thing.
Of course, we had Janet Yellen finishing off as Fed in January, and we have the new Fed chair. Do you think it's going to be steady as you go with the new Fed chair taking over from Janet?
Well, I mean, so Jerome Powell has certainly communicated a message of consistency. You know, he's reiterated data dependence, data dependence, data dependence.
Which is what Janet's song was as well.
Exactly right. You know, and I think that's why exactly why the market reacted the way it did after the jobs numbers on Friday, you know, and particularly that wage inflation number, which came in just a touch below 3%. So the market's sort of saying, well, the data is being more supportive for interest rate hikes. And, you know, I don't think he's going to be gun shy if the data continues to be the supportive. Obviously, one data point doesn't make a trend, but we'll continue to watch it. And I don't think they're going to spring any surprises. You know, I think the Fed took a lot of flack after the taper tantrum of June 2013, where we saw risk assets in the U.S. coming under severe pressure, emerging markets suffering severe outflows and their currencies depreciating very sharply. The Fed, under the rule of Ben Bernanke at the time, obviously, you know, coming under a lot of pressure then about clumsy communication. I don't think that Jerome Powell's going to make the same mistake. I think he's not going to be as gun shy as what Janet Yellen was. So if the data is supportive, you know, I think the Fed is going to move. But the bottom line is that if the data is supportive, that's a positive environment for growth. That's a positive environment for equities. That's a positive environment for companies to pass on, you know, inflationary pass through to their consumers because, you know, the economy can withstand those higher prices. And ultimately, that's good for earnings. So it warrants higher multiples, quite frankly.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at a couple of those earnings reports that have come out.
Yeah.
Some of them have disappointed, although some of them have been good. Yeah. And so we'll start with a good one. Amazon, profit of nearly $2 billion. It's the largest profit in its history.
Yeah.
And it was helped by that new tax law, of course, that was introduced by Donald Trump.
Yeah, so, I mean, they got around $800 million tax benefit on their income statements in those fourth quarter numbers because of the lower tax rates. You know, show me one company in the world which can operate on 4.5% margin and the scale of investment that Amazon has. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable. You're talking about a company that had revenues of over $60 billion in the fourth quarter, you know, up 42% year on year in the fourth quarter relative to the same period last year. Yet we're talking about operating profit of $1.9 billion, you know, and they're riding home about margins of 4.5%. You know, now every textbook will teach you that, you know, the perfect company to invest in is the company that has strong free cash flow generation, very good margins, strong barriers to entry. That's the company you want to invest in. So, I mean, Amazon definitely ticks the strong barriers to entry. I think, ironically, it's the very low margins that actually give it that high barriers to entry. There are very few competitors globally that are willing to outlay that kind of capital for a 4.5% margin. Alibaba seems to want to do a similar thing, you know, announcing plans to sort of do a 1 billion euro investment in the European market over the course of the last 3 years. I think management of Alibaba are going to get a rude awakening. Amazon has done 15 times that amount since 2010. You know, so there are the incumbents in a lot of these markets. We know the world is moving to online. That's why we're getting the rapid top-line acceleration. Yes, Whole Foods contributed $4.5 billion in revenue to that top-line number of Amazon. So, you know, strategically, that purchase seems to be working out and continuously driving the top-line number. And I think the one thing Amazon has gotten right is that, you know, they're getting this blend of the physical world and the online world right. They're realizing that, you know, food distribution is something that's exceptionally complicated, that the delivery chain is exceptionally complicated. You've got to have this refrigerated distribution chain. That's something that's exceedingly costly, you know, and they're saying instead of sinking capital into that, let's buy Whole Foods. You know, they've already got the infrastructure there, and let's focus our capex on areas of where we specialize in R&D spend, you know, where we know we've got good barriers to entry and we're not competing with a whole lot of other guys because they're not people willing to outlay that kind of capital. So, okay. I mean, at the end of the day, just a well-run company, good set of results.
But you still be buying it?
Sure, it's run up a lot, eh? Look, I mean, I think, you've got to own Amazon in the global space. I mean, the clip at which they're growing, they recently, they launched this new checkout list store, you know? So, I mean, in terms of R&D spend and being ahead of the curve, you know, you have to credit them, for being able to do that. I suppose, you know, if you look at other markets, market leaders who have benefited from that, something like Apple, you know, I mean, they've always had that first mover advantage, and look at them today. They're the leaders in the smartphone markets, and I suppose the one difference between Apple and Amazon that Apple is competing in a declining industry because the number of mobile phones in operation or the number of new mobile phones and marginal number of units being added is decreasing. We see that down just over 6% year on year relative to 1 year ago. Apple just has the greatest market share. The difference with Amazon is that they're actually appealing to a growing market. You know, more and more people are consuming goods online. You're talking about whether it's in the luxury space, it's quite interesting to look at Duke's Net-a-Porter's numbers recently because Richemont took them over, right? I mean, basically, all luxury growth that has happened over the course of the last 5 years has been luxury consumption online. We're talking about a growth in the 30%, whereas overall luxury has grown at under 10%. So the bottom line is that Amazon has those tailwinds. They're investing in that R&D, and they've got high barriers to entry because there's very few people who have the scale and the logistic base that Amazon has to come and compete at 4.5% margins.
Well, I mean, just before we get to break,
so yes, I would still be buying.
You would still be buying. Quick word on Apple's results last week, because it looks like the iPhone sales came in lower than expected, particularly for the iPhone 10. That is quite a pricey instrument. I think it's $1,000, $999.
Yeah. Look, I mean, it's staggering to imagine a company that generated $82 billion of revenue in a quarter that disappointed analysts' expectations. I mean, you know, they sold 77 million iPhones. The average price of the average unit they sold went up to around $796. So higher average price, that tells you that the iPhone X actually debuted reasonably well, because the disappointment probably came on the iPhone 8 model, because it's obviously the one that's slightly cheaper, and the market was expecting slightly over 80 million units sold. They came in at 77 million units sold, and the stock came under a bit of pressure on the back of that. Look, I mean, with Apple, the bottom line is that they're market leaders there, 19% of the smartphone market, probably at some point going to reach saturation. We know that the amount of marginal smartphones being purchased each year and each quarter is declining. So the bottom line is that it is, at some point, it's going to become a race to the bottom in that industry. You know, they're going to compete with Samsung, they're going to compete with Huawei and all the other manufacturers. I think what's going to be the next big leg up for Apple is going to be services, and is going to be other accessories. Services is a wonderful innovation for Apple. Basically, every single additional dollar of revenue is pretty much going straight into their pocket, because the R&D spend is done, right? Unless they're going to continuously bring new products, that's obviously going to add some pressure to the cost base and decrease the margins. But we're still talking about highly attractive margins, and I suppose that's what the market's going to be watching closely. For years and years, we've been saying Apple is too concentrated in the iPhone. They need to diversify their revenue base. You know, you're talking about services up 15, 20, 30% quarter on quarter. Can they continue those numbers quarter in and quarter out, year in and year out, because that's what's going to ultimately diversify the earnings base and be the next leg up for the stock.
Okay, we have to leave it there just for a moment. We're going to a short break. When we come back, we look at Investec Strategic Managed Fund. That's with co-portfolio manager Ian Cunningham. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching Global Investor. Still with me in studio is Nadir Token from 27Four, joining me on the line to put forward the investment case for the Investec Global Strategic Managed Fund is Investec's Ian Cunningham. Ian, thank you very much for joining us on the line this evening. So if somebody buys into the Investec Global Strategic Managed Fund, what are they getting?
So the Investec Global Strategic Managed Fund is a global, it's a diversified, it's a flexible multi-asset strategy. So essentially, we're seeking to deliver equity-like returns for less than equity volatility, about two-thirds of the volatility of equity markets.
So, I mean, and have the returns been matching those equity-like returns you mentioned?
So over the long term, in terms of what we're aiming to achieve, so across a cycle or a number of cycles, the fund certainly has achieved that objective.
So when you talk multi-assets, equities, bonds, cash, anything else in there?
So typically the fund is focused on, three areas primarily. So we're looking at equities, fixed income, which is across the spectrum of equities and fixed income, and also currency markets, and occasionally commodities such as gold. So a truly multi-asset portfolio.
And would that also include property in some of the space?
Yes, so we would typically include property within our equity sleeve. So obviously property has slightly different characteristics to traditional equity, but it's generally listed property that we're buying. So we classify that within our equity bucket.
Okay. So, you say in the commentary or on your fact sheets that you invest in high quality, defensive and uncorrelated assets. Does this create some balance for investors in the fund?
Yes, so the approach that we look at is really a lens that we look through in terms of a risk lens. So it's looking at growth, defensive or uncorrelated assets, and that's really to look at an asset's effective exposure as opposed to just the label that's placed upon it. So a growth asset is anything that is equity sensitive, so positively correlated with the economic cycle. A defensive asset is anything that will rise should growth assets or equity markets decline. And an uncorrelated asset is something that has a return stream that's independent of either growth or defensive assets.
So were you feeling a little bit more comfortable than the rest of the markets on Friday when we saw that big fall in the Dow Jones?
Yes, I think obviously markets have had a phenomenal run. We believe we're in the latter stages of a bull market. Sentiment measures are pretty extended. Valuations are also elevated, and investors have become far more fully positioned in equities. So I think across the past 6 months or so, we have ultimately been dialing back some exposure and building in defensive positions into certain bond markets around the world and also into certain currency markets like the Japanese yen, which tends to be pretty defensive. So we've been diversifying the portfolio. We've been increasing liquidity in general, seeking to address some of those issues should we get some further bumps in the road for equity markets.
Mm. Nadir, do you think it's a good idea to be a bit more defensive in a market like this in case there are further bumps ahead?
Yeah, look, no doubt, especially in a multi-strategy fund, you probably don't want to be full tilt given that equities have done 20% in the last year. I suppose with a fund like this, and Ian, if I could pose a question, how difficult does it become to find alternatives to equities in this market? Because, what's going to result in a bumpy road for equities moving ahead is exactly what we saw towards the latter part of last week, was expectations for inflation going up, expectations for interest rates going up, and bonds derating on the back of that quite sharply with yield spiking. So, outside of the equity market, where else would you position, defensively given that, short-term interest rates are still quite low? So, cash is not giving you much of a yield and bonds still present a risk just like equities in a spiking yield environment.
Sure. So I think ultimately that is certainly a challenge, and a lot of defensive assets around the world have been very expensive. So when we continue to look at European bonds in particular, Japanese government bonds, they are thoroughly exceptionally expensive. So holding a significant amount of exposure there doesn't make particular sense. There's two areas in there specifically that we like. Obviously markets will be volatile and then there'll be a general amount of noise that's typically coming through. But on a medium term horizon, we like longer dated treasuries. So we like 30-year US treasuries. We believe that a full hiking cycle is pretty much priced into that bond market. And we also like the Japanese yen specifically, so the yen versus the US dollar. We believe that the dollar will continue to weaken, and we're explicitly focused on the Japanese yen on the basis that investors are exceptionally short the Japanese yen. It's a very cheap currency, and fundamentals within Japan are actually beginning to improve quite significantly. And I think one thing that's worth noting in markets at the moment is the extent of investor positioning. So obviously we've seen a broad-based selling off of many assets, so bonds and equities, across the last week or so. But when we look at positioning data, investors are exceptionally long equities relative to the last 5 years, and also exceptionally short government bonds. So there's a point in the future where things will ultimately revert from that positioning.
Mm. I mean, Ian, you mentioned the dollar, and you expect the dollar in the longer term to remain weak. But 38% of your currency exposure amongst your fund is to North America, including Canada there, and your bond holdings are mostly in the United States and Canada. So how do you reduce that currency risk while keeping your exposure to those markets?
So typically the portfolio will have anywhere between 0 and 100% in US dollars. So I think as of the end of December, the fund had in the mid-30s in terms of dollars. We've favored the euro for quite some time, but we've begun to rotate that risk from European currencies into the Japanese yen. So the yen has grown to quite a decent position across the past 3 or 4 months. And really, when we're taking positions in U.S. Treasuries, for example, we're viewing those on a local currency basis. So we would naturally be hedging those positions whilst maintaining a certain degree of currency exposure if we believed that was appropriate within the fund. So based on the fund's history, the allocation to the dollar is quite low right now. In the middle to end of 2016, the dollar was as high as 75% within the portfolio.
I mean, you talked about the equity markets. Are you seeing any attractive opportunities in the equity market globally at the moment, Ian?
Yes, so I mean, in terms of opportunities on a forward-looking basis, obviously markets in the U.S. are somewhat extended at the moment, and any material setback there would probably cause a correction elsewhere, as we are seeing. I think over the medium term, we think on the basis that we expect a slightly weaker dollar through time, that should support emerging markets. We're seeing Asia in particular. There's been a lot of change within China, so reforms are coming through. Obviously, a lot of the cutbacks in terms of capacity and production within the state-owned enterprises there are improving commodity prices. So we like certain large-cap mining stocks as well, because we believe they've cleaned up their balance sheet, they've sorted out their act, and they're now into cash flow production and essentially boosting returns for investors.
Mm. Your thoughts on the approach here, Nadia?
Yeah, look, I mean, Ian, maybe just one question from my side. You know, you mentioned your exposure in the bond market. You got quite a lot of U.S. long bond exposure. It's indicating you're clearly not that afraid of the duration. I mean, you know, given the extent to which listed property internationally has lagged the global equity markets and the kind of higher yield that you're seeing in these listed property counters relative to the equivalent government bonds and the discount to NAV, is that not an attractive defensive position you're finding, given how expensive bonds and equities or relatively expensive equities are and how expensive bonds are internationally at the moment?
Yes, so I think it depends where you look. And when we look at REITs specifically, REITs fall somewhere between bonds and equities in terms of the characteristics and the way they evolve. So if we were to see a material shock in equity markets that was growth or recession risk-driven, then we'd likely see REITs sell off. Whereas we think in that type of scenario, bonds will actually react positively. Mm-hmm. And when we actually value 30-year treasuries, we actually think that 30-year treasuries with a yield of north of 3% are actually cheap.
I mean, maybe just in closing, I mean, your benchmark and how you've performed relative to that benchmark over the last period, Ian.
Sorry, could you repeat that question?
What do you benchmark yourself against, and how have you performed relative to that benchmark over the last period?
Yes, yeah, so we typically compare the portfolio explicitly against a 60-40, so 60 global equities, 60 global government bond benchmark. And I think across the past year and a half to 2 years, the fund has performed pretty well against that. So generally, in the middle of 2016, when positioning was less crowded, people were less enthusiastic, we were buying into U.S. banks, we were adding emerging market exposure, Japanese equity exposure, and didn't really have much in the way of, or we had a much lower level of duration within the portfolio at that point. And then the funds benefited from a long position in the euro and general underweight to the U.S. dollar across the past year or so. And as a function, the fund has performed relatively well compared to that benchmark over that period.
Okay, Ian, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for chatting to us this evening.
Thank you very much.
That's the show for this week. Thanks again to Nadir Token, portfolio manager at 27Four. Also, Ian Cunningham, he's the co-portfolio manager of Investec's Global Strategic Managed Fund. Thank you for watching. Join us again at the same time next week. Goodbye.